welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisbee.
I'm Kirsty Doo.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. I'm so glad I got that right because we haven't recorded an episode for ages. So when you listen to this, it'll be like a week since we recorded the last one, but it's been about 3 months, I think.
We are late to our own podcast. Maybe. I may have actually already made that joke. I may have made that in a previous episode. So if I have, it's because it's been so long.
It's been so long that on the last episode, I was slagging off people who refer to Wild Swimming when we'd read Benjamin Meyer's book. And I have since become someone who goes swimming in the reservoir several times a week. So times have changed.
Entire personalities have shifted.
For the better. Anyway, since then, Kirsty, what have you written? No, don't tell us everything. What have you been reading recently?
Recently, I've been reading Tom Lake. Speaking of, that's a lovely segue from Reservoir to Lake. I've been reading the new book by Anne Patchett, she's called Tom Lake, and it's published by Bloomsbury. It's just very recently, at the time of recording, who knows when this is going out, to be fair. But at the time of recording, it's very recently published. And it's completely wonderful. I mean, I love Anne Patchett anyway. I particularly love actually her two books of essays, which I read over the last couple of years. This is a story of a happy marriage and These Precious Days, which are incredible, and I absolutely recommend to everyone. And Bel Canto's amazing and all of that. But this is her new novel, and it is a joy, basically. It's about a woman called Lara who is in her late 50s, I think she's 57, and she and her husband live on a cherry farm in Michigan, and they have three daughters in their 20s, and this is March 2020, so, and by which I mean don't panic that it's, oh my God, COVID novel, it's not at all, but it's just the device by which these three adult daughters are back on the cherry farm. Obviously their sort of casual workforce that they normally have that come and harvest all the cherries cannot. So essentially it's become this family enterprise of the Lara, her husband, her three adult children are having to harvest all the cherries themselves. And while they are doing this over a good number of days, the three daughters are asking their mother about the love affair that their mother had before she was with their dad. With Peter Duke, who they were in a play together. Lara was a kind of up-and-coming young actress in her early 20s. She got hired for this play, which took place at a place called Tom Lake. And she had this sort of torrid, blazing affair with Peter Duke, who later goes on to become like Oscar-winning, world-famous, massive superstar actor. And her daughters have only comparatively recently found out that she had this affair with him before he was famous and so on and so forth. So basically it's her telling the story of this summer love affair, how she ended up in Tom Lake, how she started in acting, how she met Peter Duke, what their relationship was like, the play they were in, and ultimately it goes on to how she met their father and all this sort of stuff. And yes, there's that sort of plot, that basically the plot, but it's really, I think, about memory and what weight we give certain points of our lives. You know, what is a kind of memory that looms incredibly large for one person might be sort of borderline complete amnesia for someone else. There's lots of really interesting sections in it where she's sort of, you can kind of hear her internal monologue where she's talking about like, how much does she tell her daughters? You know, how much do you tell your daughters about yourself before them? Like, where do you separate the mother and the woman, and how much of that do you want to share with your children, even if they're adults and you get on really well? And how much do they want to hear? Like, how much do children want to know about their parents before, you know, there's like, you know, there's sections where she's talking about her relationship. She goes into their sex life, and then she goes, well, of course, I didn't tell the girls, you know, I didn't tell the girls this bit. So it's sort of, it's almost like that fourth wall thing of you assume she's talking, she's saying everything to the daughters, but there's stuff she's only telling the reader, which I think is really, is very cleverly done. And I was listening to an interview with her on Open Book at the weekend where she was talking about one of the things about this book is that it's a book about happy people. They're all content. You know, the marriage that she's had with her, the father of her children, has been a long and blissfully happy one. They're desperately happy together. There's, you know, they have been from day dot. You know, the family all get on. The daughters are all very close. They're close to their parents. You know, there is no one in this book that is miserable. And actually, that's quite refreshing. You know, you think about how rarely you find a genuinely compelling novel about happy people. And she does it fantastically. So yes, on the front of it, it's sort of quite quiet and sedate and charming, but there's lots of really kind of knotty little things underneath that she gets into that is, that makes it much, much deeper than it outwardly looks. So yeah, brilliant, completely brilliant. Tom Lake, do read it. Strongly recommend.
I would like to. You put it on your Insta stories when you were reading it, and I was like, I am very jealous. I think she's one of those writers, and I would, interestingly enough, my little list here is all, oh, maybe not entirely American, but her, Barbara Kingsolver, Anne Tyler, Kate Atkinson, all people that I think are brilliant storytellers, and you could, like, they can tell me anything they want, really, I think.
Yeah. For sure, for sure. And I think there's a lot of those, I mean, I know sort of Kate Atkinson or whatever, but I think there's a lot of those American women writers in that sort of age bracket who are just really fucking good.
Yeah. Well, they've been just doing it a long really time good. As well, haven't they? At this point, they've been writing. And yeah, and, you know, people like Anne Patchett and Anne Tyler, like, how many years have they been putting books out for? Like, a really long time. Well, yeah. As well, really long careers.
And absolutely.
You know, at that point where they've got you from the beginning, they know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. This total masters. I mean, she's I was about to say she's a master storyteller, but then I think a backlisted where they always use that as a kind of, he was a master storyteller, like Jeffrey Archer and stuff. And I don't mean it like that. She tells a very, very good story very, very well.
Yeah.
She's just very assured. Honestly, she could write anything, I'd read it.
Mm. Yep. Sounds good.
What about you? What have you been reading?
I have been reading also an American, but someone who's not written as many books. I've been reading Kevin Wilson's Nothing to See Here, which is published by Text Publishing and I think came out last year. I will just check. 2019. This one came
later
out
later than you thought.
Yeah, so published in America in 2019 and this one was 2020. So over here. And interestingly enough, the dedication is for Anne Patchett and Julie Bearer. So there we go. Look at us with the links today. We're on it. It might have been months since we last recorded something, but we are on fire.
Just naturally.
Which fits with the theme of the book. So the book is about, well, it starts off about these two women, Lillian and Madison. So they were roommates at school. And then Madison did something horrendous and made Lillian take the fallout for her, basically. And it's very much a class thing. So Madison's from a, well, you can tell by the name Madison, she's from a very sort of well-to-do family. And Lillian is single parent family. She's living in her mum's basement. She works in a grocery store. Madison writes to her. At this point, she is, I think she's married to, yeah, she's just got married to this guy who's trying to become a senator or is a senator. He's like quite up in American politics, trying to become a senator. I think that's right. It's been a little while since I read it. So anyway, so she gets this letter. So Madison gets this letter from Lillian saying she needs a help with her two stepkids. And she wants them to move into the, basically she gets to the house to go and see Lillian, thinking this is great, I'm going to have a nice time, I'm going to see my friend. And she's like, so what I want you to do is move into the house down at the bottom. So, because obviously they live in such a big place, they've got a house down the bottom, and look after my stepkids. And the reason she wants to look after the so it's twins, and the reason she wants them to be looked after is because when they get agitated, they spontaneously combust.
Oh, that's inconvenient.
Yes, very. And so I picked this up, obviously, because I'm into like carnival stuff, which we've talked about many times on the podcast. And some of the stuff I've seen about it, like one of the quotes here says, The Guardian says it's funny, surreal and tender. And I've seen like loads of people talk about it as if it was going to be funny. It is not funny. It is not like, I don't know. Kids' concept spontaneous combusting doesn't make me laugh. Perhaps I'm misreading it. I don't know. But I didn't find that funny. I found there's bits where it's sort of terrifying. There's bits where they are hostile towards Lillian. So you don't know sort of how this is going to work. But what happens is she sort of finds in them the thing that she's looking for, the purpose that she's looking for with her life. So it becomes this really beautiful thing where she wants to protect these kids at all costs. And she starts trying to find ways to help them and help them like manage their emotions so this doesn't happen. And it takes quite a while for them to sort of accept her as their sort of guardian, partly because they've been shoved about so much. They don't trust the adults in their lives. There is also an amazing, so there is another child who is the son of Madison and the husband, and there's a big reveal with him later on, which is just beautiful because he's a bit creepy weird and he's always sort of watching him and they're not allowed to play with him and la la la, but yeah there's a delightful reveal with him. And then just this beautiful thing of Lillian trying to work out how she's going to keep these kids protected for as long as she can, basically. And it's gorgeous. I loved it, absolutely loved it.
That sounds great.
Yes, it is very much up my street and very different to what I thought it was going to be. And I think I read, so the only other Kevin Wilson I've read is The Family Fang, which I read years ago, which I'm sure some people, I haven't seen the film, but I'm sure some people will have because it's got Nicole Kidman in, which is quite a, like, I hate the word quirky, but actually normally I hate the word quirky related to books written by women. So let's apply it to a book by a man. It's a quirky. And so I think, I wonder if that's why people are sort of reading it in the context of Kevin Wilson writes these things that are a bit weird and a bit like maybe funny, but I didn't find this funny. I just thought it was beautiful. So there we are.
That sounds brilliant. I think I have a copy of it. I'm sure I do. Obviously, I haven't read it because there are so many books that I've not read that I own. But yeah, that sounds great. So we have two books that we're talking about today. It's Crime Week.
Feel like we need to rehearse that.
Insert Crime Week jingle here. One is fiction, one is non-fiction. So the first book we're going to be talking about is non-fiction. It's Furious Hours by Casey Sepp, who is a New Yorker writer, amongst other things. And it was published by Windmill a couple of years ago and was either longlisted or shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford. I can't remember which.
Saga as well, didn't it?
It did, yes, for non-fiction at the Crime Writing Awards. And the second book we're going to talk about is a novel, In the Woods by Tana French, which is the first one in the Dublin Murder Squad series of books, which was published in 2007 by Hodder. But before we get onto that, we're going to talk about Furious Hours. And this is a book that's told in three parts, basically. There's three sections. The first part is you find out about this preacher in Alabama called the Reverend Willie Maxwell, who is strongly suspected, and indeed various legal proceedings have taken place against him for murder and insurance fraud. And the allegation is that he keeps taking out dodgy insurance, life insurance policies on various people that are close to him, all of whom seem to die in very odd ways, normally on the same stretch of highway. They keep being found dead in their cars, and definitely not murder. So I think this is right. I had to go back and check because it's a little while since I read the book, but the people who die that are close to him are his first wife Mary Lou, his neighbor Abram Anderson. He then goes on to marry his wife Dorcas herself ends up dead later on. There's also his brother John, his nephew James, and then crucially the teenage stepdaughter of his third wife, who is called Shirley Ann Ellington. All of them die. All of them have life insurance policies taken out by the Reverend Maxwell in their names. So he keeps profiting. And essentially, everyone is like, come on. Like, it's clearly him. It's obviously him. He's bumping people off left, right and centre and claiming the money on it. But he's a reverend. And he's got this excellent lawyer called Tom Radney, who just constantly keeps getting him off various charges, like just super lawyer. Then at the memorial service for his last victim, allegedly, Shirley Ann Ellington, a guy called Robert Burns, not the poet, at the service, just goes up to the Reverend Willie Maxwell and shoots him in the head and kills him. And he does it in full view of everyone because he's like, you've killed everyone. Like, fucking have it. And then in a brilliant twist, Tom Radney, the Reverend Maxwell's lawyer, is the one that defends Robert Burns for killing the Reverend Maxwell. It's tremendous. It's got everything. It's a proper, like, twists and turns, and who knew life insurance was that interesting? Not I. And so the second part of the book is about this lawyer and just his pure kind of just sheer brass neck, frankly. He's really interesting. And then the third part of the book is about Harper Lee, obviously well known for writing To Kill a Mockingbird, but she very much wanted to write a true crime book about this case. Obviously, she is an Alabamian. She wanted to do her own In Cold Blood, essentially. And we'll come on to why that might be the case in a minute. So it's a book that she's never ended up writing. And really, this is about why she didn't end up writing it. So it's the crimes, the lawyer, and the writer, basically. And it's great, isn't it?
It's really good, and I was sceptical, so I'm going to point out that you picked this. In fact, we should have some sort of award, because normally you pick them and I don't like the ones you pick, and I love this one, so...
Well, yes.
And the one that I picked we didn't like, but we'll come on to that later.
Yeah.
But because I'm a bit sceptical about true crime, so I think, I can't remember whether I talked about this, it's that long since we recorded the last episode, I can't remember whether I talked about it at the end. I feel like I've talked about it before, but I don't know if this was me and you having a conversation or whether I've said this on the podcast. Mm. But I read Michelle McManus's I'll Be Gone in the Dark and hated it. I mean, I finished it because I wanted to know what the hell happened, which I could have just Googled. But it gave me nightmares. And I'm like, I am 45. I am too old to be having nightmares about men coming in my building at night and raping me. Thanks. And I was just like, why the fuck am I reading this? Why? And obviously there's been a million articles written since then about why women read true crime. And I'm like, I don't think I'm one of them. But this I thought was great. And I think it was partly to do with the fact that I love a good courtroom drama. Like, ever since A Few Good Men when I was a teenager, I have loved a good bit of courtroom. So, yes. And also really interesting stuff. So the thing that we haven't mentioned, I don't think, yet, is that the Reverend Maxwell was black.
I didn't mention that. That was remiss of me.
Yes, which is kind of important at this point, because obviously I think that's part of the reason he's going under the radar, is because, like, you know, white people murdered black people didn't murder each other in such, like, obvious circumstances, clearly.
Yeah.
Not unless it was orchestrated by something that white people had done to create that sort of situation. So there's some really interesting stuff about the racial bias to do with life insurance policies and how much more they were paying and having to continue to pay after the after the person was dead, they were still having to pay a premium. So we sort of got on the back of this and used that as a way, like, around what he was doing, because there'd been so much prejudice against it, it meant he could sort of ride that and go, oh well, you're just doing that because I'm black. Which I kind of had a bit of admiration for, I'm not gonna lie. It's like, well, that's quite smart, you know, fair play to you, but maybe don't murder all your relatives to get there. Yes, and that comes back again when we talk about Appley, but we'll talk about that later, because obviously that was something that she was kind of interested in. And also with Tom Radney, the lawyer, who I know you want to talk about, that he was in politics before he became a lawyer, and there's some really fascinating stuff about him trying to take over the seat. So he went for this seat because the guy had been in it for years. He was called Wallace something, can't remember his surname. He had to step down because he'd done too many terms or whatever, but he was so so blatantly racist as well. And there were, you know, and Tom Radney won it, like, you know, because people respected what he got to say. And I think it's, there's some interesting stuff as well about where people sort of lines sat in terms of segregation and outright sort of KKK behavior and what Harper Lee was trying to show about the South, which she did in To Kill a Mockingbird. But there's some interesting stuff about people in publishing trying to tell her to turn it down because they don't believe that somebody can be on a line rather than either for or against it, which all sounds a bit Twitter in in the 1960s, but there we are. Yeah, that was a bit rambly. Go where you want.
I think the lawyer I found absolutely fascinating because, as you say, he had, you know, been in politics and he had been really sort of, and we should point out that he's white and was kind of vociferously pro civil rights, would kind of, you know, he was really trying to root out the kind of racists and of the various lines. And as you were saying just now, there's this kind of, this idea that you're either racist or you're not. And I suppose, you could still argue that it's all racism, but there's a scare, you know, there'd be people who would just, you know, find the Klan utterly abhorrent and what they do completely horrific. But, you know, we're still not, we don't want black people in power. Like, let's be real here. You know, it's that sort of not every racist is wearing a white hood type thing, you know, which is really good at sort of drawing out. And so the fact that you had Tom Radney as a white man taking on other white people and calling them out for racism in the 1960s or whatever is, you know, quite shocking. And he gets threats against his family, threats against him, you know, genuine security concerns. And in the end, ultimately, it's what drives him out of politics, as he just can't sort of put himself or his family through it anymore. You know, his children are being threatened and all this sort of stuff. So then to go from this sort of very earnest, very important, powerful political career to becoming a lawyer and ends up in this, you know, this situation where you got him defending repeatedly the Reverend Maxwell, where it's blatant that he's killed these people, and he keeps managing to get him off and get him off and get him off. And then the absolute balls of the man to then defend the guy who killed Willie Maxwell and essentially go, well, his defense is, well, he obviously murdered all these people, and he was just, you know, it's the fact that he just completely turns on a dime and go, well, obviously he killed all those people, and he was just defending his family. You know, it's I found that dynamic and that sort of mental gymnastics kind of completely fascinating, you know, from a psychological point of view.
I sort of feel like if you're a lawyer, you have to be able to do that, though. Like, I sort of find the thing I find about being a lawyer, I think most fascinating, is that idea that you have to defend whoever's in front of you and that they might be guilty. Like, crack on, that's your job. And I'm like, that's why there's not a cat and mouse chance that I could ever do it, because morally, ethically, it feels wrong. matter how much money you're getting paid, I don't care. But what I loved about that was the bit, there's a bit where, how'd you say her name? Sepp?
I think it's Casey Sepp. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I've heard it said that way.
There's a bit when Sepp says, Tom thought of jury trials like stage plays, and I was like, yes. And the theatrics of it all when it plays out. So the other lawyer is also called Tom, which makes it even, I don't know, funnier, I guess, even though there's lots of ways in which it's not funny. But they are, like, pushing it as far as they can. And, yeah, I guess that's one of the things that's fascinating about it, isn't it? And part of me thinks, yeah, this shouldn't be entertaining because this is literally people's lives we're talking about. But I'm going to excuse that on the grounds that there is a lot of like years between this happening and now. But yeah, and I mean, trials are when you watch. Well, some of my friends were fascinated. I've forgotten who the guy was, that American guy who clearly fucking killed. Was it his wife he'd killed? Earlier in the year, financial guy, absolutely fucking loaded.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember his name, but I know the one you mean.
But that was all my mates were watching it on YouTube because the things were coming out every day, and like that, there's still that sort of theatrical element, particularly in America, I think, of its performance. But yeah, that was really, I thought it was entertaining to read about, to be fair. And also the fact that the guy who's killed the Reverend Maxwell, they put in an insanity plea for him. And there's a whole big thing about insanity pleas at this time. And the line is this, which is just superb. Too many defendants had turned out to be insane only until acquittal. And they talk about how, like, he ends up going up to the asylum to be processed, and he's only there for a few weeks before they send him home because there's nothing wrong with him. I sort of enjoyed that whole thing about how many of them were trying to play it I read something about John Ronson, who I'm not particularly a fan of, but John Ronson was working on, and he never finished it, he was working on a book about legal experts in trials and how much they're like, how dodgy they are, basically, you can pay an expert to say whatever you want. And it felt a bit like that sort of thing. You know what I mean? It's how far can you push it, really, to see what you can get away with? And can you find someone who's going to declare that they're insane, even though they're actually not? And
I think, just to go back to what you said about true crime there, I think there is something about it being a courtroom drama. And I think of this bit more as a courtroom drama book than a true crime book, although obviously court by its nature, it's crime and it's true. But I think there's something that sort of, it is that theatricality that makes it a removal. You know, it's not about sort of, you never actually see the crimes as they were. You hear about what happened to these people and how they were found and all that sort of stuff. But it's not, you know, in the way that true crime feels to me at the moment, especially the way, you know, there are so many true crime podcasts and TikToks and God knows what that really get into the gory details. And it's sort of, that's the stuff that makes me feel really icky, because it's the kind of the salacious details as entertainment. And you can dress it up as, oh, this is all for educational purposes as much as you like. But is it though? Whereas this sort of courtroom scenario inevitably has that sort of theatricality about it. And yes, it is people's lives, and these are crimes that have been committed. And it is around someone being convicted or not for it. But what's entertaining about it isn't the crime, it's the way that this is argued and played out and what happens. And also, I think there is something in knowing essentially that he basically got away with it. You know, there was, you know, he did spend, you know, a few weeks in the asylum, but other than that, you know, there wasn't any sort of huge miscarriage of justice in the end. Ultimately, you could argue that all those court cases with Willie Maxwell before were the ones that were the miscarriages of justice. So it sort of feels a bit more safe to be entertained by it in a way.
Yeah, because you're absolutely rooted. Well, I was rooting for Robert Burns to get off. Of course,
of course, absolutely
deserved it. Like, I know that that's not a thing that should happen, but still, he fucking deserved it, and nobody had sorted out. And I sort of wanted, and I doubt they could go back and do it now, but they suspected he was poisoning him, didn't he? But it was a poison that obviously they couldn't test for at that time. And I'm sort of like, oh, can you not? Is there not a way to find out now what it was? I sort of wanted to know what he was managing to get away with. Because there was clearly something. And there was a bit, wasn't there, with, I think it was Dorcas, the second wife, who there was possible evidence that she'd been strangled. There was something to do with her tongue, I think it was. And they discounted it because there wasn't any sort of other evidence. And I'm like, come on, there must have been something. It was like frustration with the police who were meant to be investigating it, who were just, or the coroner or whoever. But I guess if they didn't have the test for whatever at that time, they didn't have the test. But
no.
So frustrating.
I know. But then you come on to the third part of the book, which at the first look, you go, well, where does Harper Lee fit into all this? Like, what's, you know, other than it's in Alabama, what's it got to do with Harper Lee? And somehow she manages to turn a book that the first two thirds of it have been this courtroom drama, this extraordinary lawyer, his career, his past, a whole chapter on life insurance.
I love the chapter on life insurance.
It's surprising.
The highlight.
Yeah. But then she has this whole section on Harper Lee. And I think you were the same. I did not actually know a huge amount about Harper Lee. I mean, I've read To Kill a Mockingbird. I know that she was friends with Truman Capote. Like, I know that she lived in New York and she never wrote another novel. Apart from Go Set a Watchman, talk about that. But I really didn't know much about her, if I'm honest. And so it does go into her life, into her family, her various family dynamics, how she ended up going to New York, how she became a writer, which was really interesting. But it ends up with her desperately wanting to write this story as a true crime book in the manner of In Cold Blood, as a kind of reportage. But she's just never able to do it. And it's really interesting as to why that's probably the case, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that Sepp ever gets to the bottom of that. And I think that's possibly because Harper Lee would need to have seen a therapist to work out why it was. There's obviously, so this is only from, clearly I am speaking, I'm projecting now, I'm talking from personal experience. But if anybody who's read Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way will know that Julia Cameron talks in that about how you stop yourself from doing it and there's a reason, and it's possibly stuff you've been told as a kid, or like you stop. I wonder if it was to do with the fact that To Kill a Mockingbird was so successful. That was the block. So there's some really interesting stuff in here about why. So she stopped writing after To Kill a Mockingbird because her tax bill was so high that she didn't earn any more money. And I'm like, where do you think? And I guess that's growing up in a, like, she wasn't in a poor family, but I guess a family that weren't particularly wealthy, and that, you know, worrying then that you're going to run out of money. And obviously the book's never been out of print. It sold like however many million copies. The film that she got rights to the film as well, some level of rights to the film anyway, so she was getting money off that as well. So like she was never actually going to run out. This wasn't really like having to pay a massive tax bill wasn't really a problem. And I know there's a bit where Sepp estimates that it was 700 grand tax bill, and I was like, yeah, gutted for you, love. Absolutely devastated.
But she had, when she first moved to New York, she was earning money to live and not able to write. And there's this extraordinary gift that these sort of friends, colleagues, you know, sort of essentially bestow patronage upon her and go, right, take a year off. Here's a load of money. Just go and write your book. Go write it. Forget about work. Just go and do it. Which is such an extraordinary, generous thing to do for someone. But she obviously, I think, had that debt hanging over her, which obviously she repaid. But there was that sort of, I need to earn money so that I can write, and then didn't write because she didn't want to earn money. Interesting.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. So there was a thing where she ended up finishing it earlier than she expected to. So I think she did it in 9 months, but that was partly to do with, she used Go Set a Watchman. So I've always had a problem. We'll come back to this in a second because I'm just going to derail the conversation if I go off now. But I've always had a problem with the fact that Go Set a Watchman was ever published. But she had that, and she had another novel that she was working on. Essentially what she did was marry the two together. And she had an editor who supported her with that. So there's sort of a big thing about it. And it's in the same way that she did loads of the groundwork for Truman Capote. So, yeah, so she had sort of support doing that. And then the people who were trying to support her, I mean, it talks about the point when they died and she'd lost that sort of system. And that was really interesting because one of the people who was supporting her was, is it Donald Campbell? and his partner was something Wyndham, and I was like, oh, that's the Wyndham Campbell prize. Anyway, that was just a random aside. As I was reading it, I was like, ah, I don't know what that is. But Sep says this, which I thought was really interesting about her inability to finish it. She says, and I mean, I guess like this is partly, again, this might be projection on Sep's part, but it rang true to me. So she says, unfinishedness is an emotional category as much as a chronological and aesthetic one. Plenty of artists keep revising and revisiting their work long after the critics and the public have deemed it done. Perfectionists, and Lee claimed to be one, often refuse to call it quits and have trouble handing off their work to editors, agents and readers. Do you still hang your words in air 10 years unfinished? Robert Lowell once asked in a sonnet for his friend Elizabeth Bishop, whose fastidiousness was famous. She was known to pin poems on her bathroom mirror and kitchen corkboard with spaces for single words she was trying to find, then leave them literally hanging for years. And it reminded me of someone that was on my master's course who I'd hand stuff in and go, yeah, it's as good as it's going to get for now. And she would still be sitting there like right up to the deadline, like editing bits. And I'm like, why? Why are you doing that? Guess which one of us is published and which one isn't. Which, like, you know what I mean? She's a better writer than me. She was a better writer on the course, but she just faffs with stuff. And I'm like, And I've got to a point where I will stop faffing and it goes and that's it, innit? Because next time, hopefully, you're going to write something better than what you wrote before. And I wonder if that's part of the issue with Harper Lee. I mean, how do you top To Kill a Mockingbird? It sold so many copies. Like, you're kind of in a bit of a bind there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's that sort of, you know, you think about those sort of trivia questions of name novelists who have only published one book. And it's sort of To Kill a Mockingbird and Gone with the Wind and I've forgotten them all now. But it's that sort of almost as well known for only having written one novel or until recently, Go Set a Watchman Aside, as the novel itself in some ways. But what I, just to sort of change tack slightly, what I had no idea was how involved she was in In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, which it's, you know, incredibly famous true crime, you know, sort of archetypal true crime book. I've read it. I think it's very good. I have an amazing 1970s paperback edition that's just the most ridiculous cover. I love it. And I knew that they were friends, both from Alabama, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, she basically did a load of the legwork. She's sort of the one interviewing people and typing up research and like sheafs and sheafs and sheafs of notes that Capote's just then turning into, you know, in Cold Blood. And, you know, frankly, in many ways, I think you could probably claim that she at least co-wrote In Cold Blood, if not more. And he was sort of famously sort of flaky as hell. In fact, there's a book just come out recently. I haven't read the book, but I've read quite a few of the reviews. It's called Capote's Women, where it's, you know, this sort of set of socialites that he would hang out with, and then absolutely bitch about, you know, to everyone else. And he was right, you know, when he died, he was writing this novel that was sort of incredibly thinly veiled, like completely recognizable, just horrendous stuff. So the fact that I think Harper Lee was this friend that he fell in and out of touch with, and she did half his work for him, it just, yeah, feels on brand.
Yeah, I did know that she'd put a lot of work into that. I also know that there were so many rumours about the fact that people were trying to make out that Capote wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And I'm like, all right, I don't think you've got the discipline to like do it. But I thought what I also thought was interesting about this, and this is something that I didn't know, was how much of In Cold Blood was, I don't know, shall we say, fictionalised?
Yes, yeah, for sure.
She really didn't like how much she'd... And I sort of... It's an interesting one, isn't it? And I think we've talked about this possibly before, because I've got a big thing about it, about stuff that's deemed to be nonfiction, that's, you know, like, how much can you actually remember about what was said and all the rest of it? And there's a theory in this that puts forward a theory that maybe Harper Lee didn't finish the book because she couldn't see a way to do it without things being in there that weren't strictly true. So in Cold Blood, I've not read it actually. I've got a copy. I've had a copy for years and I've still not read it. But I know there's a conversation at the end that never actually happened. So yeah, and it does sort of make me feel queasy because, you know, and I think things have shifted a bit, and this was partly to do with, oh, I've forgotten his name, the one that Oprah had loads of trouble over, who wrote...
Oh, James Frey.
Yes. Yes. Who published, I mean, I think at the time we were still calling it autobiography, weren't we? And now it's become memoir because it's your memories rather than what actually happened, because James Frey made some stuff up. So, yeah, I find all that stuff fascinating. But, yes, in terms of, like, what was supposed to be reportage, and obviously Harper Lee had trained as a journalist, so she clearly felt queasy about that.
Yeah, and so she's trying to write the story of Willie Maxwell and Tom Radney and Robert Burns faithfully, but just never manages to do it.
Yeah.
Or never finish it. I wonder what it would look like. Like, I wonder how she would have framed it.
Yeah, well, that's what Sepp suggests she's having trouble with, isn't she? That there's no sort of person. And I guess that's why Furious Hours is put in those three separate sections. Because when I started reading it, I was like, I don't like this structure. I thought I was reading something about Harper Lee. Where is she? But actually, it made sense once you'd sort of got to the... when she appears, like, it made perfect sense as to why she did it like that, because otherwise you'd have had such a messy sort of complicated back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely, because you'd have to break off, you know, if you were starting with Harper Lee, you'd have to have all the kind of Harper Lee biography, how she got to that point, and then break off for the, this is the crime, this was the courtroom, this is the lawyer, this is the whatever, and then somehow come back to it. So I think, yeah, so you know that Harper Lee's in the subtitle of the book, you know Harper Lee's on her way, but she doesn't turn up till the last third, and it is very, very cleverly done, the way that it's almost like the lens sort of moves out, so you've got the crimes, the courtroom, the lawyer, the writer, sort of moving backwards, which is she does it very well.
She does. And I could totally see it, like, being turned into some sort of film or TV.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, you'd have to think about it then. You would have to frame it differently if you're doing that, but you could do it in chapters. Anyway.
Or a podcast, multi-episode podcast series.
I'll write the TV show. I can see how I'd structure it.
So we both like that book very much.
Here's a segue. Yeah.
So the other book we're going to talk about is In the Woods by Tana French. As I said, first book in the Dublin Murder Squad series of novels, originally published in 2007. So it's won loads of awards, both here and in the US. So it won the Edgar Award for Best First Novel, which is the big crime fiction awards in America, in 2008. Now, I said at the end of the last podcast that I had read and really, really liked Broken Harbour, which is actually the fourth book in the Dublin Murder Squad. I didn't realise it was in a series when I bought it. I thought that was brilliant. And so I was really looking forward to this. And before I start talking about what I thought of it, a brief précis of the plot without spoilers. There's a guy called, well, originally his name was Adam Ryan. When he was 12, he and some friends were playing in the woods next to their house in a kind of small Irish town. All his friends that he was with go missing, and he is found completely traumatized, his shoes full of blood, sort of up against a tree. He has got no memory of what happened. He's got no idea what happened to his friends. He's got no idea what happened to him. It's completely gone. And obviously the case was hugely famous because they've never caught the person responsible. And so he was moved by his parents to a boarding school in England. He now goes by his middle name, which is Rob. So he's Rob Ryan for the majority of the book. And he's lost his accent. There's a thing about him having perfect sort of BBC English from his time at boarding school. He's never really told anyone that he is Adam Ryan, the child that was in this very famous case. He has gone back to Dublin. He is now a newly member of the Dublin Murder Squad, the homicide sort of investigation department. And he, by all accounts, looks the part. This is what he's been training for his whole life, really. He's got the coat, he's got the suit, he's got the mannerisms, he's good to go. A girl called Katie Devlin goes missing and is found dead in the same small town where he grew up, not a million miles from where what happened to him happened. And so him and his partner, as in job, you know, police partner Cassie Maddox, start investigating the crime, and echoes of the past start happening, is essentially what the book's about. I really, really liked like the first third of it. I was absolutely tearing through, and then I have to confess I slightly lost interest. It's quite long.
That's not my cue.
Yeah, I think it's a bit too long.
I'm just going to stick the boot in from the off. And there were things about this I liked, so I will talk about them. But I thought this was crime written for people who are too snobby to say that they like crime books. That was my take. It could have been, I don't know if they're all the same, because I've got this really weird, do you remember those really weird size paperbacks you used to get that are quite small? I'm going to hold
it. Format.
Yes. So I've got it in one of these. So I don't know if this means I've got more pages. Then you might have in a slightly bigger one, but it's 592 pages in my edition.
And I read it on the Kindle, and it just, the numbers of percent did not go up very quickly.
So I'm like, if it had been 290, it might have been a cracking story. And also, one of the sort of plots isn't solved. So that's annoying. That is annoying. It felt like, I'm going to air quote, literary crime. Yeah, for people who say that they don't like crime novels. And I'm like, what I wanted was a banging crime novel. And that's not what I got.
Yeah, and I was really disappointed because I thought Broken Harbour, which is also a long book, by the way, I can't remember the exact page count, but we're, you know, it must be in the ballpark of 500 pages. And I loved that book. I thought it was brilliant. And so I absolutely think people should go and read that. So don't read In the Woods. Go and read Broken Harbour, because it there's also quite a lot of the same sort of thematic obsessions, that's a really derogatory word, concerns, I suppose, in that I think some of the most interesting stuff in the Woods is around, there's a property development sort of storyline, there's stuff around the kind of corruption in Irish politics. Basically, the father of the girl who's been murdered, Katie Devlin, is involved in a campaign around a proposed motorway being built, and actually where Katie is found is there's an archaeological site where they are trying to kind of investigate and preserve the ground that the motorway is proposed to be built on. And you know, there's a huge amount of interesting stuff around, you know, who's given bungs to who. There's a guy on the team who they keep trying to get information out of him because his uncle is like involved in politics, and they're like, how many brown envelopes has he got? And that sort of stuff, and all that kind of Celtic Tiger and that kind of stuff, which I thought was brilliant and really, really interesting, is also in Broken Harbour, which is set on like a ghost estate, like this half built, you know, housing estate. And then the Celtic Tigers crashed and things had never been finished and half the houses are empty. And there's like a handful of families have moved in, but there's still loads of empty, derelict, half built houses, you know, half finished roads and all this sort of stuff. And it's a really compelling setting for a murder mystery where basically a family has been murdered And it's, it, you know, the murder squad come and investigate that. And it's, there's something incredibly eerie about half-finished buildings, even if they're the shiny new build half-finished buildings. So there's definitely, you can see where her preoccupations are, and those are the best things about it. But I think the problem for me, and I think this is an interesting discussion, is just how unlikable the main character is. Mm-hmm. Rob, Adam, however you want to address him. And what I couldn't figure out is whether he was meant to be unlikable. Now, I'm not one of these people that's like, oh, I have to love all my characters. You know, we should, I'm not, none of that bullshit. Unlikable characters are great. But I can't work out whether he was supposed to be unlikable or whether we were supposed to sympathise with him, because if we were meant to sympathise with him, I did not.
Yeah, I don't know. And I sort of felt ambivalent about him, to be honest.
Mm.
I think, I mean, I had the same problem. So I mentioned at the end of last episode that I didn't like the Witch Elm. And part of the reason I didn't like the Witch Elm was because there was this really obnoxious male narrator. And here we were again. And I was just like, why? Especially because Cassie's way more, like the women altogether, apart from his roommate. Sorry, that was a very American way of putting it. Flatmate. He lives in her flat, doesn't he? Flat. I mean, she's irritating, but you're getting a completely filtered through him, so it's quite difficult to tell exactly what she's like. But Cassie's great. There's also the sisters of Katie who's been murdered. They're really interesting, and the mother as well in the family. They're sort of interesting. So they were more interesting than he is. And actually, his friends, when you start get to the point when the lads who he was with on that day, and you meet them as adults, they're interesting as well in various forms. I think more than like not like him, I just didn't give a shit. I was like, yeah, you're obnoxious and I'm not bothered. And I found, so absolute spoiler, but of course, because there's this male-female partnership and it's all about how Cassie's his best mate and la, 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 la. And then, of course, they shag at one point. And I'm like, why did you do that? Why? Like, it would have been so much better, because then he just acts like a total dick to her. And you just, because he thinks that she's going to fall madly in love with him. And you're like, fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I found that really frustrating, because up to that point, I was sort of really rooting for them as a duo, because, you know, all the way through it is this kind of, oh no, we're just mates, we're like brother and sister, you know, one sleeping on the other's couch. And there's all, you know, in the department at work, everyone's like, oh, they must be shagging or whatever, and they're not. And that felt so refreshing for them not to be, and then they did, and it completely ruins their relationship. And I was just like, oh, did we have to, can we not just have, like, the book didn't need that, the novel, the narrative, like, it didn't need it. Because I mean, it wasn't even really a way in which to move characters on. Spoiler incoming, so do you know, move on if you don't want to hear this. But ultimately, you know, at the end of the book, everyone finds out in the police that Rob is Adam Ryan, is the child from this famous case, and he's moved out of the murder squad and sent off to some clerical department somewhere else. And it's like, that, none of that needed him sleeping with Cassie to happen. Like, if that's what you're going to do with your character, I just don't understand why that was there. And it's a shame, because actually I loved Cassie as a character, and I would read a novel with Cassie as the main narrator or main sort of point of view any day of the week. Yeah,
me too. And she's quite a good foil for him, especially when when they meet with the sisters. So Katie's got a twin sister called Jessica, and then there's an older sister called Rosalind. And he fancies the older sister, and Cassie cuts right through the bullshit that he's spinning her, like, with that as well. Because, yeah, well, there's some question over how old she is, isn't there? And he never actually asks her, so he gets a bit of a shock. But, yeah, that stuff's really interesting. And, yeah, the other stuff, so I liked the property development stuff, I thought was interesting, and stuff about Celtic Tiger, like you said, but also the family dynamic. So the family that Katie comes from, there's loads of questions around what's going on within the family, because it seems like there might be some sort of Munchausen's or by proxy, or whether there is some sort of manipulation going on, or even if there's sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And that sort of the unraveling of that is really interesting. Yeah, that sort of what is going on, who's being manipulated, what's happening, why weren't they in the house, what, you know what I mean? There's all sorts of questions around that. And that was the central bit of the novel to me. And yeah, was the bit that I was most engaged with, was finding out I guess it's that family dynamics are interesting, aren't they? So what was going on?
And yeah, absolutely. And actually, if you strip the novel right back, the crime and how it is solved and the unraveling of it and who's said what to who and who's manipulating who and who's lying and who's telling the truth and blah, 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 that's all great. Like that, like you said just now, you know, if it had been a 290 page novel about that crime, banging, absolutely fantastic. But there was just so much other stuff that felt like a total red herring. It felt, and I get that there's red herrings, I get that red herrings are there to throw you off, to, you know, obfuscate what's really going on, and, you know, so that the reveal is a good reveal. But it just it felt like there were too many herrings, too much herring, multiple fish,
too many fishes for a book set in the woods.
Exactly. There shouldn't have been so many fish in the woods.
I think that's where we leave that. I can't stop it.
Got to change of pace next week.
It's sex week.
Jingle that too. Yeah, so we are looking at two collections of erotic stories. Gird your loins. So we are looking at Anonymous Sex by Cheryl Lulian Tan and Hilary Jordan, edited collection of erotic stories by well-known writers, but we don't know who wrote what, which I think is an interesting concept. And then the other book we're looking at is Unreal Sex, which is a collection of queer science fiction, horror, otherworldly erotic stories, which is edited by So Meyer and Adam Smith. So plenty to get our teeth into next week.
With many innuendos, I suspect.
Many innuendos. Yeah, look forward to that.
Definitely. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. I'm just going to do Instagram because God knows what's happening on other social media sites at this point. But Kirsty is at Other Kirsty. I'm at Naomi Frisbee. So we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.